We should have sound and we should be live. We should have live feed on sermon audio. It should be on Generation Word page, but we're struggling with that. And it is on Facebook and on YouTube. Okay, we are continuing in eschatology. We've gone all the way through the Old Testament, gone through the Gospels, and we're at Matthew 24 and 25. We got to yet go to the book of Mark and see what Jesus says there and the book of Luke for the same account. But in Mark and Luke, it's going to have a slightly different way it's being presented, a slightly different way of wording, maybe some different things that are being emphasized. In the end, it all has to kind of tie together, and that's kind of what we're looking at, just looking at all the details and our eschatology to all kind of fit together. If you struggle with certain things, you got to somehow figure out how to make it fit. Otherwise, there is some things that are mysteries that we don't understand. But remember that, you know, what God told Moses, that the things that God has revealed belong to us and to our children, but the secret things belong to the Lord. These are the things that have been revealed because they're in the text. So we should be able to understand them. We may struggle with them. But there are some things that are hidden that they've never been revealed and we'll never understand them. You know, like, you know, the exact time that it's going to take place or some details or even some of the in-between events that would be nice to know or we would like to know, they haven't been revealed. They're not for us. But the things revealed belong to us and to our children, which means, in the book of Deuteronomy, that we should understand them. We should study them. We may struggle with them. We may have to work with them, but they have been given to us and they belong to us and we should know them. So we're in Matthew 24 and 25, and now we've actually got Jesus talking himself about the eschatology. A couple things in review. The eschatological age, in a sense, began when Jesus was born or when he was baptized, began his ministry. And it's going to, we're in that, what we'd say, the final days or the end times. We see that in Peter's account. We saw that yesterday in the opening of the book of Hebrews. In these last days, eschatology, I mean the last or the end, the study of the last, the study of the end. And so in these last times, and they were writing way back here, in the first century. We've gone through all this time. And as we go through time, one of the things that becomes potentially a problem, we've talked about this before, is that, you know, Satan is trying to bring about the Antichrist, and he gets to a certain point, and then God will bring some kind of judgment or reset history and send it back again, and Satan will start working his plan, and it'll get so far if it be like Nero, or if it be Antiochus Epiphanes, and then God will then bring some kind of judgment, will overthrow what is being taking place. You know, Antiochus Epiphanes will die, or Nero will commit suicide, and things will go back, and it'll be reset. And then you're going to have all these events, even in our modern age. You're going to have World War I, World War II. Hitler's going to appear. It's like, this is the end, this is the end. And then Hitler's done, and it resets, and it cycles back through here. And it's going to continue, just like it says, until whoever is holding him back is taken out of the way, the Antichrist can't come. So these would all, potentially, in one way of looking at it, are all saints trying to bring about the Antichrist. That's why Antiochus Epiphanes and Nero and Hitler, they all look like the Antichrist, but it gets canceled out. And not until it is taken out of the way, or he who's holding it back is taken out of the way. Again, we could talk about who that is, what that is. Jesus breaks the seals on the document, the seven seals. And once he breaks the first seal, guess what takes place? The rider on the white horse comes forth. He breaks those seals. And now we are in what we'd say these last 7 years or the final 70. And so that's why people, you know, could get confused. They get excited. We're living in the end times. It looks just like the end times. Right. But is it the end times? And then there's some kind of a judgment, some kind of a reset, and we go back and do it again. And so we may be in something like that today. People are like, well, we're in the end times. This is exactly what it's supposed to look like. Indeed, maybe we are, but unless he who's holding him back is taken out of the way and Jesus breaks the seals, this is going to, the days that we are in, whatever's going to happen, America may go into judgment. It may be replaced by, you know, whatever comes next, and we'll just cycle back and we'll continue on through history, and we are not in the end times. We're living in this eschatological age because the Messiah came and began it, because he's going to do two things. He's going to pay for sin, and he's going to bring total judgment and the kingdom. And that is what the Messiah is going to do. He's already done this part. We're waiting for him to return and finish his mission of the building of the kingdom. So that's kind of where we're at. And that's one reason why sometimes things can get confusing. And it's like, well, things just go on forever. Yeah. And that may be why John was crying when he sees the scroll and no one can open the scroll. And John begins to cry in the book of Revelation because this thing's just going to cycle on forever until the Lamb appears. He's the only one worthy to bring about the final days of history because he's the Alpha and the Omega. And here we begin. So in Matthew 24, Jesus himself is addressing this. So if you go to Matthew 24, I'll review a little bit about what we talked about last week. And again, we could go into a lot of details here, but I've got some things we want to look at. We've got five parables, and these five parables are going to make points about what Jesus has said. And in Matthew 24 and 25, he's going to make sure that he makes it obvious that no one knows the time, that it's going to be like the days of Noah when it happens, meaning people are going about their daily lives. They're eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. Before he returns, life will be normal. People are trying to maintain a normal life. And then suddenly, the disaster, the judgment came. And then there's going to be a separation, talking about people that are together in this age, in this life, working together. All of a sudden, there's going to be a separation, and one is taken and one is left. Now, again, when we look at that, we don't know if they're being taken away for judgment or taken away in deliverance. The point is, they're being separated. You could say they're being taken away to the sheep and goat judgment, or they're being taken away on the day of deliverance, on the day of the rapture, and they're separated. Again, it's not clear in the text what kind of a separation is, but the clearness is there's a separation. And then there's the five parables that we'll look at. But in Matthew 24, we see this in chapter 24. They call attention to the buildings and how beautiful it is. And he says, do you see these things? I tell you the truth. Not one stone will be left upon another. Everyone will be thrown down. Later, Jesus sitting on the Temple Mount or on the Mount of Olives after having left the temple for the last time. And they ask him three questions. When will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So when are these things? When is the temple going to be destroyed? And as we looked at this last week, it's going to be destroyed in 70 AD. And so he's going to talk about the events of 70 AD or 66 to 70 AD. And then he's going to talk about the sign. What will it be, the sign of his coming and the sign of the end? What will it be like before the end? And he begins this right here. And we talk about in verse, Jesus answers in verse 4, watch out that no one deceives you. That's always the theme. Paul says that often. Jesus says that throughout. Whenever anyone talks about eschatology, they're telling you, do not be deceived. This is an easy area to be deceived because it's in the future. It hasn't happened yet. And people can manipulate this information either in ignorance, maybe I'm in ignorance, or people can manipulate this information for their own advantage or, you know, and so it's easy to be deceived in this because you don't have historical evidence. It hasn't happened yet. So do not be deceived, for many will come and claiming, I am the Christ. Now, again, sometimes right here in verse 5, people sometimes take this, and this is appropriate possibly, and put it into the 70th week. That's the Antichrist, the false Christ, the coming. That could be, but I think he's answering this question here in these first verses about 70 AD, the time between his talk right here in 30 AD and these next 40 years. This is what's going to happen. There's going to be many false Christs, and that's what's going to lead to the destruction of Jerusalem. There's going to be they're going to find a Messiah-like figure to lead them against the Romans, which is like a suicidal mission of the Romans. They're trying to avoid that in 30 AD, but by 66 AD, they're ready, they think, to take on the Romans, and they find a false Messiah. And he goes through and talks about they'll hear of wars and rumors of wars, and all these things, famines and earthquakes. And people keep trying to make that sound like, you know, something's that those are the signs of the end. But throughout this very clearly, he makes it clear that these things are going to happen and it's going to continue. It's going to continue to cycle like that through history and until the gospel of the kingdom is preached in verse 14 as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So this is going to continue to cycle until the end. We're just going to have famines. That's normal. That's normal life. Wars and rumors of wars. I mean, think about it. If every time there was a war, it was the end of the world, or every time there's an earthquake or a famine, surely this is a sign of the end. There's been signs of the end every day since Jesus said that there's been a famine, there's been an earthquake, there's been a war, there's been rumors of war all for 2,000 years. So it's kind of like those are an indication of that's what life is going to be like leading up to the end. And then he begins in verse 15. He says, so when you see the standing in the holy place, the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, and that's, again, the Antichrist in the holy place, setting up some kind of an image that's referred to in the book of Revelation. Paul talks about it. That is very clearly, I think, very clearly a breaking point in this last 7 years is in the midway point. Daniel talks about it. Jesus quotes him right here. That at the halfway point, there's going to be the desolation, some kind of an image. The Antichrist is going to take over the temple. He's going to make it his own. Paul talks about it. He says there's going to be a falling away. The day of the Lord, day of the Lord, cannot come until, he tells the Thessalonians, you're not in the day of the Lord because you're going to have the falling away, which is, again, people falling away from the faith, possibly because of great persecution by the Antichrist, who the Jews have signed a treaty with, and they think they've found the happy land. They've found their political leader, but they've found the Antichrist, not the true Christ. That's why they're so shocked when, one, he deceives them, and then next, the true Christ appears in the atmosphere. And so that's when they're going to have the day of repentance. But when you see this abomination set up here, you know what to do. And now he starts talking to the Jews right here, giving advice. Now, he's talking to both believers and telling the Jews what to do because the apostles are going to be the founding of the church and what they're going to face. And they're also going to be the Jews living in this age right here on what they're going to need to do. And that's where we're at right here. Verse 17, when this happens, the abomination, let no one go to the roof of his house. You need to get out. It's going to be terrible. And for there will be great distress, verse 21, distress unequaled from the beginning of the world until now. And that great distress, again, if you allow me to teach it, again, I'm telling you what I think it is. But whatever happens, that's at the halfway point. That's pretty clear. I mean, you really can't argue with that. Daniel, Jesus, Paul, the book of Revelation, all is aiming towards this point right here. That's the pivot point. That's the marker everybody can build off of. But this has been a great time of distress leading up to. That's your four seals, I think, opening up the rider on the white horse and great persecution of believers. So it's been a time of distress. But after this takes place, now there's going to be a great time of distress unequaled from the beginning of the days until now. So it's not the distress caused by the Antichrist or persecution. It's distress caused by the appearing of the Lord bringing down the trumpets and the bowls and the wrath that he's pouring out right here. And again, you got to keep this in mind because through the history of man, one of the great, some like a preterist would say, it's the fall of Jerusalem. It's the worst days in history. Well, they were pretty bad days for the Jews. But there's a lot of people who didn't even know what happened. I mean, it recovered, and the sun came up, the sun set, it rained, it didn't rain, life went on as usual. It was a bad day for Jerusalem, but it wasn't the worst days of history because it already had happened. The Babylonians had already burnt the temple once. So it's like it's a repeat of something that's already happened. But you do have to consider that if this is the time of great distress, sometimes called the Great Tribulation, this is going to have to outdo the flood of Noah. Because Jesus is not ignorant, and the writers of the scriptures or Matthew is not ignorant of Noah's flood. And so when he says, this is worse than anything the world's ever seen. And the flood is, I mean, that's pretty bad. Except for the fact that the flood just wiped everybody out, and you're alive, you're flooded in some kind of a tsunami. I mean, if you think about what took place, boom, you're dead. This is going to linger on, and the Lord is going to, in a sense, pour out these judgments. And you're going to be basically within the last few moments of history before Jesus comes back. I mean, there's no water. I mean, the water's been polluted. The earth is in great turmoil. I mean, there's disease you can't be cured from. It's terrible. So it's one thing to get killed in the flood, but it's another thing to have to live through this. It even says they seek death but can't find it because they got the COVID vaccination. That's what, and I don't know why. But it's like, I just threw that out there. But you begin to wonder when people start injecting. And again, this is going to be canceled and everything. I just got signed up. I'm going to get canceled. But you know, something, the Bible says that they're going to seek death but can't find it. I mean, how can you seek death And you can't die. I mean, what? I mean, surely you could like put yourself in a blender or something and just grind yourself. I mean, I don't know what that whole thing means, but it's like surely they cry to the mountains, fall on us, but they can't escape, they can't get out of life. So I don't know, you know. Though that's what you know we've been that's been revealed. But what does it mean? Even the mark of the beast. What is it? I mean, it's like well, it. I mean, we got ideas, but I mean, I don't think you're going to know that in detail until you see it potentially. Okay. Nonetheless. This is a time of great distress. That's what you see in verse 21. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. At that time, anyone who says, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it, for false Christ and false prophets will appear. So as this day begins, people are going to be telling you he's over here, like he's going to be in the wilderness forming a military. He's not out in the wilderness in the desert. Or he's in the inner rooms making a peace treaty. He's a political leader. That's not the Christ. The Christ is not going to come back as a military leader in the Judean wilderness and march on Jerusalem. He's not going to come back in a peace treaty and in a political. He's going to come back like this. It says, verse 27, for as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will the coming of the Son of Man, so is the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures gather. Meaning it's going to be that obvious. You can look up and see the vultures, and there must be a dead body down here somewhere because the vultures are circling over it. Jesus, you look up, boom, there it is. Well, that's the Messiah. That's the Christ. It's not like, well, I think he's out in the wilderness. I think this might be his political party. Or is he making a peace treaty? It's like, no. No one's going to have to tell you about it. It's like it's as obvious as a vulture's circling. Everyone can see it. And so it says, verse 29, immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be dark and the moon. And now we got all these events matched up in the sixth seal of the sky going dark. And there's some kind of a presence in the atmosphere, apparently, earthquakes and everything. And judgment begins to be poured out. Verse 30, at that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and all the nations will mourn. See, they didn't mourn at the flood of Noah. They just wiped out. And there were no nations at the flood of Noah. There's just populations. The nations were formed afterwards to keep that from ever having to be done again. The nations will mourn. That same thing takes place in the book of Revelations and another place when it refers to this day of the Lord. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather the elect from the four winds from one end of the heavens to the other. Now, that I think, and this matches up with Thessalonians, we could go through this. The Lord is going to appear, and I believe right here, that is where we meet the Lord in the air. We will meet the Lord in the air. We will go there and meet the Lord, and not going to go away, but we're going to meet him and escort him back here. That's what the word would mean. The Jews are in hiding. They see this. They begin to mourn, and that's where we're gathered together. This matches Paul's teachings in Thessalonians, because I think that Paul may be referring to this. He says, according to the Lord's own word, this is probably what he's looking at. So we can leave that hang right there. I'm putting the rapture over into here, which I think makes sense. You can discuss that as you go. Now he says, verse 32, now learn a lesson from the fig tree. As soon as the twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know the summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth. Okay, now, when you see these things, when you see the abomination, you see the Lord appear, you see this, it's like it's time. These things are going to begin taking place. When you see it's like a figure, these are the signs he's talking about. And then he says this, and this is, again, interesting. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Now, when he says all these things, we need to think about, was he talking about all these things? Because if he means the abomination of desolation, the sign of the Son of Man, the worst days in the history, this generation in 30 AD is not going to pass away, well then, we're interpreting it wrong, or they got it wrong, or something's wrong. So what we need to do with that verse is use it, compare it to other places in Mark and Luke. And that would referring to this generation that is going to begin the church is going to see the fall of the destruction of the temple. The original question, when will these things happen? The fall of Jerusalem, this generation, 30 A.D., to 70 AD, that's 40 years, that's a generation, we'll see these things. When will the temple be destroyed? Well, I tell you what, you'll see these things this generation. You will see these things. But now, when is this going to take place, this eschatological event? I think we're going to see this is going to take that's not being set. The date is not being set. He tells them when the temple is going to be destroyed, but not when the end is going to take place. Because right in verse 36, he just says, verse 34, I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son. So in one case, he says, you're going to see these things in this generation. Then on the next thing he says is, no one knows. It's like, well, you just told us it's going to be this generation. We can pretty much start nailing it down right now. But he says, well, no one knows. So this is, I think, again, this is me explaining it. This doesn't mean it has to be the right answer. We still got to study these things. This generation, 30 AD, will see the destruction of Jerusalem and these cycles begin to flow. The wars, the famines, and all this stuff as history marches on. But this day and hour, no one knows. Like I said, this is going to continue to cycle. This is going to continue to cycle. It's going to look like the Antichrist. Look like the Antichrist is going to look like, and it's going to keep cycling until he who's taken is taken out of the, holding it back, is taken out of the way, or Jesus breaks the seals in Revelation. And then that will be the time of the end right there. Now, these next part right here, what I've said, that's kind of what we taught last week. Again, I was very sloppy going through it. Now on these notes, we've got I've got two things on these notes tonight, Matthew 24, 36 through 41, and going up to verse 41, you're going to see three things there. Number one, no one knows the time. Jesus makes it explicit. No one knows the times. The point, you got to be ready. You got to be looking for it. Next, it's going to be normal. Life is going to be normal even when these end times begin. People are going to be going about their lives normally. It's going to be in the days of Noah. And then when it happens, there's going to be a separation. So here we go. That's the first things we're going to see up to verse 41. And then we've got five parables we'll look at. Here, I'll read this. Verse 36, no one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son. Now, when we say the Son, we assume he's talking about the Son of God, the Son of Man, Jesus Christ himself. And when it says not even the Son, now you've got to do some theology and think about this. I mean, the second member of the Trinity, who is God, doesn't know the end, when it's going to take place. And again, that's a tough thing. Only God the Father's keeping it a secret from the rest of the Trinity, which means he knows something they don't know, which now you're messing with the Trinity, and what's that mean? One way of understanding this is the Son on earth, he's got his ministry as the Son of God on earth. These are things are not, he is not something he understands as a man. Again, he was always God. He thinks as God. He remembers being God. He remembers creating things. He remembers talking to Abraham. You know, he got in trouble for that. And I talked to Abraham. I saw Abraham. And Abraham wouldn't have agreed with you. They said, how do you, you're insane now. You never saw Abraham. He says, before Abraham was, I am. So apparently he can refer to things as God. We know that, even as a man. But this is something he wasn't able to maybe teach or understand. I don't know. But it's hard for me to think that he is now ascended, is at the right hand of God, and it's still like, don't know. Now, again, you can see it taught either way. But he says, in other words, there's no point here. You can talk about that. But the point is, I don't know. Even the Son of Man didn't know. The angels don't know. So your local prophet or your TV prophet, they don't know. It's like that's a sure sign that you're speculating or manipulating or you're in ignorance. You start setting, no one knows this time. Now, again, we can see the signs, but a lot of times those signs are just cycles. We don't know when it's going to actually take place. So that's very key. For in the days before the flood, verse 37, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. And the coming of the Son of Man was that, I believe, the sign of the Son of Man when he appears. That first 3.5 years or so of the tribulation, there's going to be great persecution. There's going to be some kind of famine or at least the storing and distribution of food, so the rationing of food. Some get it, some don't. We can see that. So that's been going on throughout history. So people will be living their lives normally, eating and drinking, marrying and being given in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. They're going to be going through their lives following the Antichrist, the world leadership, however they've got it set up, their one world government, and that's all functioning. It appears they're going to be persecuting Christians. The Jews are going to be celebrating on the Temple Mount. Everything's functioning fine until the Antichrist breaks the treaty, and then they go into hiding. But now the Antichrist has got peace. He's got everything under his control, and everything is fine, not for the Christians, and now at this point, not for the Jews. But then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, the sign of the Son of Man appears, and now they're all scared. That's where the nations begin to mourn. So they'll be going about normally. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Now, here's the next point, the separation. This is what will take place at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the handmill, one will be taken, and the other left. The handmill was circular, and there's a handle and a stone that would roll around. It had like, you'd have a basin, and the ones we saw in Israel were like basalt stones. And then you'd have a basalt stone sitting on top of that, and you'd roll that around. There'd be a handle here, and one woman would take and move it in front of her. And the next, this is a woman's job. The men were in the field here in this story. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't want to be sexist, but the men were in the field. The women are grinding food. And this one would move this way. The woman sitting on the other side would grab it, move the other 180 degrees, and they'd be both working the millstone. Working, that's how close they were in their relationship. Maybe they're both servants. Maybe they're both, you know, daughters. Maybe it's a mother and her daughter, but they're both working. But when this happens, we don't know the time. Normal life is taking place, but boom, there's separation. Two men are in a field, meaning they're working together in their daily routines. One's taken and one's left. Two women, one's taken, one's left. Now, I can't tell you, I'm not all over the map. There's only two places to be with this. They're either being taken away for judgment, or they're being taken away in deliverance. But there's a separation. If you've got the rapture right here at the coming of the Son of Man, the one that would be taken in deliverance, in salvation, for the day of the Lord, and the one that is left is going to enter into the trumpet and bowl judgments. If you've got a pre-trib rapture here, then the church has already been delivered, and this isn't the rapture. The one that's taken would most likely be going to have the second coming where Jesus, you know, sets up his judgment. The sheep and goat judgment we're going to see is at the end, and the one that's taken is taken away in the sheep and goat judgment. But then that doesn't make sense because both the sheep and the goats go through the judgment. One is kept and one is torn, and they're not grinding. So that's the situation. One is taken. The key point being there is there will be a separation at that point. So that's just, and this is Jesus' teaching. Again, all this we can start building on, connecting verses all around this. We're just trying to do like a general overview. But those are the three points right there. We don't know the time, life will be normal, and there will be a separation. And now we begin a series of five parables. Chapter 25 has got three parables, but we could say five parables, and they all teach something. And this is what I'd like to shoot through tonight, if we can. Here we go. So now, beginning in verse 42, the points of this is going to be things like be watching, be faithful, be prepared, be working, be productive. That's all many of the themes of these parables. Therefore, because this is true, we don't know the time. It's going to be like a normal day. One is going to be taken and one is going to be left. Therefore, keep watch because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. So, but understand this. If the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Now, again, be careful with this. And again, maybe you could, but first the warning is be careful. It's like a thief coming, T-H, is it I-E-F? Thief coming and the owner of a house. Meaning if the owner had known when the thief was coming, he would have been ready for him. He would have been sitting here sleeping normally, but he knows it's coming at 3 o'clock. He'd get up and meet the thief. But you don't know. The owner doesn't know when the thief is coming, so the owner has to be alert all the time. Be careful. I don't think in here, well, the thief represents the owner. It means theologically. Jesus is going to come to the earth at a time you don't expect him. Just like an owner doesn't know when the thief is coming. Jesus is, he's like a thief, But I don't think we're trying to build any kind of a case that Jesus is like a thief because of. The point is, it's going to surprise you. You've got to be ready all the time. So in parables, and I can teach them both ways. I can go into great detail every little figure, and then you get really abstract and you make it go all kinds of directions, and it gets really confusing. The point is, be ready. You don't know. Just like the owner doesn't know, you don't know when Jesus is coming back. And that's the point of the parable. And again, you could try to tie it into something else and build your doctrine on it, but that's kind of sketchy. You start building doctrines on parables. And even I tend to do that sometimes. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? So now the second one is going to be the servants, we'll say two servants. And they're in charge. You're going to have a servant that's in charge. This would be like a Joseph-type servant. Now, the servants we're talking about here, the word would also be translated slaves. They were slaves with responsibilities and some freedom. And when we think of a slave, we think of someone that's, you know, chained to a fence somewhere. And they you know, but these would be servants like Joseph was. He had his own ring, his own signet ring. He signed for certain things. He was in charge of all of Potiphar's household, which means he had his own place, had his own wardrobe, and he'd go out and he'd oversee, he'd have his own work schedule. He had servants, slaves working for him. And that's what we're talking about here, a servant who is serving the Lord, in this case, in peril. And he's got servants that he's in charge of, but he's not just in charge, you do this, you take care of what I want you. He's got to take care of them. He's got to make sure the schedules are set, they have food, they've got clothes, they've got, you know, the equipment they need. And so they've been given an assignment. Who then is the faithful? I'm in verse 45. Who is the faithful and wise servant? Now, this is Jesus preparing you for eschatology or the end times. If you're going to be faithful waiting for him, you're going to have to be like the faithful servant. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in the household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. In other words, for some people, when the Lord returns, you're going to be one of his servants that he's given you an assignment. If you want to think of the church having, you all have a spiritual gift, you all have a place within the church. When he returns, are you doing that? Are you functioning in that role? Whatever you're supposed, we all are providing for the church. Each part of the body provides for the other. We need the church. So if you're part of the church, which you are, you should be providing something. Now, I'm, for example, real simple illustration, I'm providing Bible teaching, okay? Now, everybody's got to be teaching Bible, but there's something, you are here for something, and you should be a servant that's providing for the servants. Now, see what I'm doing? I'm taking the parable, I'm already running down a railroad track with it and trying to tell you what it means. Jesus is saying you should be a servant taking care of the servant. See, I'm making an application to it. I got to draw that back in, otherwise we're going to go off on a sermon. And see how these things can lead you off and start making application for them. Nonetheless, I mean, that's the thing. When I read that, because sometimes in my own mind, I want to, like, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm going to quit. But the thing is, if you quit, well, I worry about this. It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. Jesus, the master, is coming back, and he's going to find me or you either doing what you're supposed to be or not. Now, if you're not doing what you're supposed to be, I tell you the truth, he'll put him in charge of all of his possessions. He's going to take him and come on in. I've got more for you on the other side in eternity. But suppose that servant, now I read this, suppose Galen is wicked and says to himself, my master's staying away a long time. It doesn't even matter what I'm doing. How do I know this is would be possible? Because I've thought this before. You know what I mean? I've thought, it's like, why does it matter? I mean, nothing's happening. It's just life goes on like usual. It's just day after day. Ah, you're becoming a wicked servant. I'm talking to myself. Instead of doing what I'm supposed to be or what I think I'm supposed to be, I say, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to coast through this and just, it's like, ah, you just went from being the faithful servant that's going to be rewarded to becoming the wicked servant that says, I don't know what's going on. I don't know when he's coming back. I don't even think it matters. Is he even paying attention? He may not even know I'm here. Ah, these are thoughts that roll through my head. It says, I tell you the truth, he'll be, okay, But suppose the servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. Now, one thing we want to look at this is this phrase right here. It's going to come up a couple more times. And because we're so anxious, we miss it. Because what Jesus now is telling them parables, and notice what all these parables have to deal with. A long time, a waiting. It's like they're not ready because they fell asleep. They got tired of waiting. They thought it happened quicker. A long time. But if the master takes a long time, the wicked servant will say, it's taken a long time. My master is staying away a long time. And he then begins to beat his fellow servants. In other words, instead of serving the servants, making sure the servants have the food, what is he supposed to be contributing to the servants so they can be productive? He begins to use them for his own advantage. He begins to beat them or use them for his own sake. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him. Why? Because you weren't even looking for him. And at an hour he is not aware of, he will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The hypocrite, in the sense that he says he's a servant of the master, but his actual behavior is to abuse the servants he's supposed to be taking care of and finding, getting their job assignments and providing them their food, whatever the overseeing servant is supposed to do for the other servants, because it was a long time. So there's the wise and faithful servant. And that's something that every time I read that, it's like, And then you got to decide, cut him into pieces. That was what happened in the book of Daniel. That's what Nebuchadnezzar was talking about. And, you know, so that wasn't a form of, you know, cutting people up so there's nothing left of them. They'd tear down their houses, pull the beams out of their house so their houses would collapse, their families would be killed, they'd be cut up into pieces. I mean, there's not, your memory's gone. And so that's kind of what is being said. It's like, well, that's kind of harsh. Well, yeah, God's judgment is kind of harsh. It's not going to be like a little, you know, there's discipline and there's punishment. And then there's also, you know, some kind of the wrath of God. And this guy's facing apparently pretty severe wrath. Now, chapter 25, we go into three parables. And again, this could take forever and ever. The first is the 10 virgins. And you can hear again, you're going to hear within this the long time. They're not prepared for the wait. They all had oil. They all had a lamp. But what five of them weren't prepared for was that this is going to take longer than I thought. So right in there is another warning. It's like, here's the judgment. This generation will not pass away until you see these things. But let me tell you a story about the other end of this eschatology. Is it's going to be a lot longer. You've got your lamps lit, but you better have some extra oil because the oil you've got is going to wear out. Well, here we go. And when it says virgins, this is just talking about the emphasis not on virgins. It's the ideal of a bridesmaid at a wedding, and they're unmarried. They're just young girls involved in a wedding activity. That's the idea. At that time, the kingdom of heaven. Again, the word virgin means virgin, but what we would use it as. But the word is being used as these are young ladies involved in another woman's wedding. At that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like, remember the kingdom parables? Here's another one. Will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now, again, I think it's safe to assume the bridegroom is Jesus coming back because he's the one who's going to show up late. He's going to be the show up. There's a big celebration. So the bridegroom is going to probably be Jesus. So there's 10 girls, young ladies, waiting for the bridegroom to show up for the party and the festivities to begin. Five of them were foolish and five of them were wise. How? The foolish ones took their lamps but did not take any oil with them. Now, again, when it says they took their lamps, now you got to go back and really get into the text. They took their lamps, but all they did was bring a flashlight. Did you bring batteries? No, I brought a flashlight. That's ridiculous. No one's going to just buy a flashlight and not bring batteries. No one's going to bring a lamp. I brought my lamp. Well, did you bring any oil? Oh, I didn't even think about oil. I mean, maybe I wouldn't think of oil, but if you're living in this culture, they would think of oil. Just like I'm not going to buy a flashlight and think, I've got a flashlight. But did you buy batteries? Oh, I probably don't need batteries. I mean, I know I need batteries. Probably what they have, and you can read as we go through this, they didn't bring the extra oil. They brought their lamps with oil in them. This will be fun. We're going to go over here and we'll be ready to go. And then all of a sudden, they're all going to fall asleep. It's going to be late at night. They're oil lamps. In fact, when he comes back, it says it's going to be in the present tense. We're beginning to burn out. They were burning out as they weren't burned out. They were beginning. It's like, oh, they're starting to flicker and there's nothing left. It's like a gasoline engine. It's like you got gasoline, but it's like, I think I'm running up. Yeah, you're out of gas. And that's what this is talking about here. The point here is they were not prepared for the long time. They weren't prepared for the long wait. The wise, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps. And I'm assuming, and I may be wrong, but I think it's correct, that there's already oil in their lamps. They brought an extra jar just in case it's longer than they would expect. The bridegroom was, here it is, a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. Now, there's no condemnation for being drowsy and falling asleep in here. It's tough because it says, be alert, be awake, and now they fall asleep. So, but this is not, the emphasis here is not that they fell asleep. Notice the parable is switched. We're not talking about, oh, they were wicked and they all fell asleep. Well, no, the point is he was gone so long that it got late into the night that they fell asleep. I mean, it was natural that they would fall asleep because the point is how long he was. Again, here's another parable about how long it's going to be. He's warning them, be ready, and it's going to be a long time. Now, if it's going to be within this generation, we'll see it. It's going to be a long time because, I mean, their whole life, if you'd walked with Jesus and heard Jesus talk and were beginning the church and saw the Roman armies coming, I mean, you surely aren't going to fall asleep. You know, I mean, he's coming right now. He's coming soon. But this is talking about after all these things take place, it's going to be another long time. So even there's some room for the fact that we've got 2,000 years. Okay, at midnight, a cry rang out. Here's the bridegroom. Come out to meet him. Then all the virgins woke up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish ones said to the wise, give us some of your oil. Our lamps are going out. Now, again, these are not selfish little girls that aren't sharing their oil. The point is not that you should have shared your oil, girls. Notice the girls that didn't share their oil are not sent to the outer darkness for not sharing their oil. It was saying, you can't share. You either are ready or you're not. You either are prepared or not. I can be prepared, but if you're not prepared, well, share some of your preparedness. That's the point. I can't. You should have been getting, I was telling you, you should have got some oil. Then the virgins woke up. Okay, verse 9. No, they replied, there may not be enough for both of us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves. But while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him and to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the others also came. Sir, sir, they says, open the door for us. But he replied, I tell you the truth, I don't know you. Therefore, keep watch because you do not know the day or hour. Now, they're coming back. I would like, if I were to make an application of this, again, you don't, I'm just going to make this application because for me, it's just hanging there on my eschatological chart. There's what we'd call the second coming. There's the beginning of the tribulation. There's the abomination at the middle of the 7 years. Here's the sign of the Son of Man appearing in the atmosphere where all the, you know, the sun goes dark, the moon goes dark, the stars disappear, and the nations mourn and run and hide in Matthew and in Revelation. And that's where we go to meet him in the air. We go up to meet him in the air. The angels gather from the four winds of heaven. And the Jews who right here, they went off and they're like confused because the Antichrist they signed a treaty with, they're like over here like in confusion. Now he appears. They're over here. These believers are ready. They had the extra oil. They had what they needed. These people didn't have it. They made it to this point, but they're right here. They're running out of oil. It's like, we don't. And now they see in Zechariah, they mourn for him. As they mourn for son, the one they pierced, they recognize him. There's national mourning. It's like, okay, you're the Messiah. It's like, sorry, you missed it. So we could have the five wise virgins. Again, I may be pushing this. Five wise virgins are the Jewish believers who have the born again Holy Spirit, born again. These are the five Jews that are unbelievers. They are Jews, but they've rejected Jesus. They're going to now continue on. They accept Christ, but it's too late. They got their oil. They went and bought the oil, but you're not part of the church. You weren't part of the rapture. That may be a mistake in making the application, but there is an emphasis on the oil. And that some have the light and extra oil, some have just the light without the extra oil. So there's a distinction. And what's that mean? One, the indication there, once again, is emphasizing, nothing else, You need to be prepared for a long wait. Because then you got the whole idea of the bridegroom coming and the people being taken and gathered in and the door being shut. It's just like, it's just almost for me, it's screaming for what do all these things mean? You don't need all of that other stuff if you just say you should have extra oil so you can make it through the night. Again, I may be making a mistake. So the third is the 10 virgins. Now four, and we got, okay, we may make it, boys and girls. Okay, the parable of the talents. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and another 1 talent, each according to his own ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who had received 5 talents, okay, so the man who takes, he's got servants. Again, these are servants, these are slaves, but they've got tremendous responsibility. I've got it written in my notes if I can read this. When it says talents, 5 talents, almost $3 million today, and I probably wrote that in the 80s or the early 90s. So it'd be the equivalent of 16 and a half years worth of wages. So he gives them 16 and a half years worth of wages. Figure it out with your own pay scale. Figure out what it is. He gives them 16 and a half years. That's the 5 talents. And then the 3 talents would be, the 1 talent would be, more than a 16. Okay, I got a bunch of notes scribbled in there. I have to read through them. But nonetheless, you can see the amount of money they were given. Then he went away on a long journey. So he's going to give these slaves this money that's his. And he's going to go away, and then the ideal is that he's going to return and want his money back. So here's what the first one does. The first one, he has the money. The man who received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So what he was given by his master, it was his responsibility. He took it, and however, maybe he, you know, built some apartments, maybe he invested it in a GameStop stock or something, whatever. But he did something with it, and he's now got his own share. He's got the same thing that he was given. He took it and went to work with it. And now what we're seeing right here, if you look on the notes, the talents adds a new quality. Point A under point or number 4A, the need for improvement and growth. We so far have seen these things. Be watchful. You got to be waiting. Be prepared. And you got to be performing. You got to be doing your work. But this is adding something new right here. This is adding the ideal of growth. Or of production. Now, we are not just waiting and being faithful and not getting drunk in the world. We've been given something. If it's your life, if it's your time, if it's your gift, you've been given something. And it's not just you're supposed to just hold on and wait. You're supposed to take that while he's gone. He's actually giving you time to invest this and make it grow. So the person that is going to make it grow is going to be rewarded with something greater. You can see this. So we're talking now growth. This is Jesus explaining to his disciples. And again, if he wants growth, he's going to have to be gone a period of time. He's going to have to give you some time to grow. And so that goes back to what Peter was saying. The Lord's slowness is so that others can come to repentance. The longer the Lord's away, the more time we've got to bring people to the kingdom or to develop our gift or our place. So it's like, oh, why is the Lord not here? Well, because it's growing season. Okay. Okay, after a long time, okay, at once and put it together. Verse 17, so also the one who was given 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After, and then we're going to find out why. Because he thinks, one, it's the master's money. Why do I care? If I make any money with it, if I produce anything, he's going to just take, I'm his servant, I'm his slave, he's a boss, he's a harsh owner. If I turn this into whatever, if I turn it into, you know, a multi-apartment complex and make millions of dollars with it, when he comes back, he says, oh, that's all mine, and takes it, why would I care? Why would I waste my time serving him? Or if I do invest it, and let's say I invest it and I lose, now I'm in trouble. So for the guy that's got the 1 talent, his thinking is, I've got this one. whatever I do with it is going to belong to him. And if I invest it and I make a mistake, he's going to be ticked and judge me for losing it. I tell you what, I'll just put in the hole right here when he gets back. Here, I knew it was a lose-lose situation. If I invested, I might lose it. You'd judge me. If I made anything with it, you're going to take it. I'll be with it. I'm in the same position I would have been. I can't win anyway. It's like, that ain't the way it works. And he's going to get in trouble. He was saying, it doesn't matter what I do. I can't win anyway. I can't make you happy. You're going to take it from me, or you're going to judge me for losing it. After a long time, see, third time, at least the third time, verse 19. After a long time, the master of those servants returned. If you were on the edge of your seat thinking the end times were here in 30 AD, these parables would have taken the wind right out of your sails. Because Jesus kept saying, I'm going to go away, and after a long time, I'm going to come back. How long? So long that everybody fell asleep. So long that you had time to turn my five into five more. It's not like overnight. I'm going to be gone a long time. You need to be ready for a long time. He keeps saying that. So the idea that they thought, they didn't know. The man who had received the five talents brought the other five. The master, he said, you entrusted me with five talents. See, I've gained five more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share in your master's happiness. In other words, there's many things on the other side. You did good here. Wait until you see what I got for you over there. The man with the two talents also came. Master, he says, you entrust me with two talents. See, I've gained two more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who'd received the one talent came. Master, he says, I knew that you were a hard man, harvesting where you had not sown. What's that mean? I'm going to do all the harvest, sowing and harvesting, and you're going to take it. And gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid, you know, one, you're going to take it from me. And I was afraid I might lose it. And then I'm in real trouble. And went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. You gave me this, you can have it back. Huh. And here it is. I got chart on my table right there. I got three charts. Okay. His master replied, you wicked and lazy servant. So you knew that I harvested where I had not sown and gathered where I had not scattered seed. Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the banker so when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he who have will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him. In other words, what he loses it, and he's going to give it to someone that's been faithful and productive. So he's going to lose the one. And then, wow, watch this. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So, again, what does that mean? I mean, if you don't produce and grow in your Christian life, you're going to go to hell? You don't want to take that parable and make that doctrine. Because you've got to plow all the way through all of Paul's theology, all of the New Testament, all the character of God in the Old Testament. And that's not what it means. We'd have to go back and understand that servant, the reason he thought God was a hard man, or Jesus the Lord was a hard man, that he did not know him. He didn't understand him. He had a pagan image of him. He did not know the God of the Bible and just gave him a typical world view, a theological world view of the world to the Lord or to the master. And he was, you didn't know him. So that's why I would say, if you want to talk about losing your salvation, this parable is not about losing your salvation. This parable is about growing and spending some time with what God's given you. Okay, now, this next one is a parable. It's called a parable. It may be more of not even an allegory, but a more typology, because I think this is right out of Joel chapter 3. Because Joel chapter 3, I'm going to go there. I've got it written down there on your notes right there. So go to Joel chapter 3. Okay, we got 6 minutes, folks. Joel chapter 3. Patient with the Bible teacher looking for Joel here. Joel chapter 3, And just listen to this. We've already read this many weeks ago when we were going through the Old Testament. Joel chapter 3, this is talking about the Lord, the Messiah, before he's revealed as Jesus. When the Jewish Messiah comes on the day of the Lord, he's going to set up camp and judge the nation. So here we go. Chapter 3, verse 1 of the book of Joel. In those days and at that time. Now, that's a phrase that's an eschatological phrase of the end days, not just the end times, but in that day, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. Now, that's the restoration. That hasn't happened yet. That's at the very end. That's after they've gone through all this period of being disassociated with the Antichrist, going into the wilderness and then being brought back. They're going to have their fortunes restored. It's promised in all the minor prophets. There's going to be a restoration. When I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, watch verse 2, I will gather all nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat is a word that means the Lord judges. And the valley of Jehoshaphat is assumed to be the Kidron Valley, or extending down the Kidron Valley through a wadi that runs down to the Dead Sea as water would run. It'd be just east of Jerusalem. It appears that the Lord he's got an actual place. And he's got actual clientele that he will be judging, the nations. He's already restored Jerusalem. We know the time. It's when Jerusalem has been restored eschatologically. We know the place. The Kidron Valley extended, the Valley of Jehoshaphat going towards the Dead Sea. We know the clientele. It's all the nations who mourned when he appeared that now they've been brought. He says, I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, where the Lord is going to judge them. So he would have appeared already. Now he's come back in his kingdom glory. There I will enter into judgment against them. I will judge them, the nations, concerning my inheritance, my people Israel. I will judge the nations on how they treated my people Israel. Because what you're going to see is I think the next verse says it. For they scattered my people among the nations and divided my land. The Lord has sent them into the different nations throughout the dispersions, and they've been wandering the earth in different nations, the Jews. Now he's going to restore them. But now the nations are going to be evaluated, particularly from this last 7 years, this seven-year period, when he returns and he sets up his kingdom right here. How did the nations be treating the Jews during that time? They're being judged on how they treated Israel. They divided my land. They cast lots for my people and traded boys for prostitutes. They sold girls for wine that they might drink. And then he goes on and talks about it. Okay, so that's just a verse in the Old Testament, okay? Now, chapter 25 of Matthew, verse 31. I mean, this for me is a slam dunk what this means. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. Now, understand, he is already in heavenly glory in heaven. So Jesus is on the throne. He's at the right hand of God. He's surrounded by angels. But now he's coming to the earth, and he's got a throne on the earth. It's the throne of David, per se. And he's got the angels with him. So he's brought his heavenly glory to the earth. All that says in verse 32, all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. So all the nations will be gathered, and they'll individually have to pass before him, and the sheep will be called sheep and put on the right. The goats will be placed on the left. Now, how is he dividing them? Well, if it's Joel chapter 3, he's dividing them on how they treated his inheritance, Israel, while they were scattered amongst them. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. So clearly we're right here. They're entering the kingdom. They're being welcomed into the kingdom. He's come in his glory. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you loved me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer him. Now, these are the righteous from all the nations. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord. There's so much you can do right here, because if you go through this, the Christians have already been raptured, you see. these are people from the nations that necessarily weren't really even born again. They're being judged on how they treated Israel. Again, so this is kind of touchy because we're going to have some people in this kingdom age that are not going to be resurrected. They're going to be normal people living normal lives. And that we can see that in Ezekiel. We can see that throughout the prophets. So again, that may tie into this right here. So don't be careful when you connect this to salvation. They're being welcomed into the kingdom. Again, I'm not saying it doesn't apply to salvation, but they're being evaluated on how they, well, let's read this. He says, you came and visited me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in or needing clothes or clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison or go to visit you? The king, notice they're calling him the king. The king will reply, I tell you the truth. Whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did it for me. Now, who are the brothers? If you go to Joel, he's judging them based on how they treated his inheritance, his nation, which is his brother, because he's a Jew himself. They're his brothers. I mean, that is a straight up hardcore reading of that text. You see what I'm saying? With Old Testament prophecy support. Now, if you want to say that's talking about how people treated the poor throughout. I mean, the point is there, too. If you visit people in prison, if you go. But this is not just a general, this is an eschatological event. It says right at the beginning, when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will gather the nations to be judged. And then he's going to judge him on how they treated his inheritance, his brothers. Then he'll say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angel. This is for sure the lake of fire. This is for sure damnation. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. And I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. They'll also answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty? We certainly would have stopped what we were doing and helped you, O king. Look at this. I mean, who's not going to help you? And he goes on. They say the same thing. They says, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, a stranger needing clothes? Verse 45, he'll reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do it for me. Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. And the fact it says eternal life there gives a huge indication that these people are born again and they've recognized the Lord. Now, again, you obviously, and you've heard that preached, you know, I mean, in going out and reaching out to people and how you treat people. And obviously the application is there. How you treat other people is how God is going to judge you, you know, as if you're treating him. So, I mean, I'm not saying the application there. If you see a homeless person or you see someone in need and you just walk by him, that goes right back to the parable of the Good Samaritan. That was the same principle. They just walked by. It wasn't an eschatological parable, but the principle's there. They stopped and helped somebody who was even considered a political enemy or a national enemy. They helped a Jew, the Good Samaritan, help the Jew. And so again, the principle is there is helping anybody. As believers, we should be helping others. But eschatologically, stuck right here in chapter 25, coming after chapter 24, it's got an eschatological ring to it, especially when you've got Joel chapter 3 saying he's going to gather them and he's sitting on his throne in glory judging them when he comes back to Jerusalem. So again, those are the things we see right there. The thief has got to be ready, or the owner's got to be ready because you don't know when the thief is coming. The two servants, make sure you're doing your job and helping people, helping those that you're in charge of. Don't be using them. The virgins, make sure you're prepared for a long wait. The growth, you've been given something, make sure you produce with it. Don't just wait for the Lord. You've got time. The reason you're waiting is you've got time. During this time that you're waiting and you got extra oil in your lamp, start producing something so when he gets here, you've taken the five he gave you and you've made five more. And then this is a story, I think, talking about, I mean, obviously we need to talk, to, treat people correctly, but that's really not the context is not the servants of God need to be treating people correctly. The context there is the nations need to be treating the brothers of Jesus. And who are the brothers of Jesus? Everybody he's created? Could be. Is it the believers? It could be. Or is it the Jews? Probably so, because you've got Joel chapter 3 supporting that idea. So there is chapter 24 and 25. The five eschatological parables, and there's room there for a long wait and to be prepared. You don't know the time, so always be ready. And you put that in the idea of this thing just keeps circling and cycling through. We could get very discouraged, say, it's never going to happen. And Peter warns in 2 Peter that their scoffers are going to come and say, it's never going to change. It's going to go like this forever. It's like, no, not. It's going to come to an end, and it's going to surprise many people. So that's that. We'll look at Luke next week. And in Luke, we're going to see a little more detail. We can break it down. The same questions, the same story, same Mount Olive's message. But he's going to actually give you more detail about the ages and what's going to take place as far as history and the fall of Jerusalem. He also ties into the same things we saw here as far as eschatologically. So that will be interesting. And then somehow we got to get over to Mark and do that. I'll pray, and you're free to go. Thank you so much for being here. Father, we do thank you for your time, your word. We thank you for the chance and the time to look into these things. We ask that we would allow these things to transfer into our hearts and not just be words and stories and a theology, but also be something that we are living expectantly, living in a way that is serving you, knowing that you are watching and going to evaluate our performance. And Father, also in the sense that we are ready and diligent to be patient and not give up because things are taking too long. Father, we especially pray at this time because of the situations we're in as we're cycling through another moment in history. We ask that we again may find encouragement and strength from these words, but also be able to share the truth with others. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.